begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, plucky larcenist Lady P, no relation to Master P. And my guest slash co-conspirator today is screenwriter, film historian, and professor at San Francisco State University, Joseph McBride. Welcome back to FlixWise, Joe.
Hi, it's always good to be with you, Pauline, and it's great fun to talk about movies, especially Ernst Lubitsch.
Exactly. You're blowing my tease here, but here we go. Long-time listeners will hopefully remember Joe's previous appearances on FlixWise, including our recent episodes on Carol Reed's The Third Man and Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo. On those and several other of Joe's appearances, he has mentioned that he was working on his long-awaited book on the works of famed German-American filmmaker Ernst Lubitsch. Well, at long last, the wait is over. Joe's book, How Did Lubitsch Do It?, has been published by Columbia University Press and is available for purchase at this very moment. It offers detailed critical analyses of every single extant motion picture that Lubitsch ever directed, including his Hollywood classics such as Ninotchka and Shop Around the Corner, as well as his career-making early musicals such as Love Parade and One Hour with You, and his early silent work that he made prior to emigrating from Germany. On today's show, we're going to talk about the evolution of Herr Lubitsch's style, which includes that early German work, to the early American operettas, and eventually to what he would become best known for, the romantic comedy. And we're going to explore the development in Lubitsch's work by way of analyzing what many consider to be the apex of his career, the 1932 feature Trouble in Paradise. In a passage from How Did Lubitsch Do It?, Joe describes the film as a, quote, gem-like piece of work, which remains the summit of the form all these years later. We'll discuss what makes Paradise so exceptional and talk about how it helps shape many of our established notions of the rhythms and themes of the Lubitschian form of filmmaking. Just a quick summary for those of you who have not seen Trouble in Paradise. One would hope every film fan on the face of the planet has seen it, but just in case... Trouble in Paradise tells the story of two grifters, played by Miriam Hopkins and Herbert Marshall, who meet in Venice, Italy, and attempt to scam every poor sucker on their canal, including each other. But of course, this being a Lubitsch film, they proceed to fall in love and combine forces to take on a bigger con in Paris, France. This particular con involves scamming a wealthy widow, played by Kay Francis, and taking a portion of her inheritance with them as they dash about Europe. However, their plans go awry when Marshall's Gaston Menescu character accidentally falls in love with Francis's character, Madame Coulet, and he must then choose between her and his life on the lam with Hopkins's character, Lily. This brief summation hardly gets at what's so charming and alluring about this picture, but then how does one go about describing something as ineffable as the particular magic of Lubitsch's comedy? But if anyone should know how, it's you, right, Joe?
Well, thank you very much. I've tried, and, you know, you use that word ineffable. That's a really good word. Andrew Saris used it about Lubitsch a long time ago, and it kept coming back into my mind when I was writing the book because it's very hard to write about and capture the Lubitsch style in words on the page, and I tried my best. But it's kind of the problem with film criticism in general. How do you capture a motion picture with the moving images and the music and the sound on the page? But that's the challenge.
Right, right. And that's one you took up with this most recent project. Before we jump right into the book, let's talk about just quickly about Trouble in Paradise, because I know it was sort of a formative experience of yours when you saw the film, right?
Yeah, when I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where you are, back in the 60s, I first saw Trouble in Paradise, which was my first glimpse of a Lubitsch film. And it was a very exciting period for me. I was running the Wisconsin Film Society, and we had 35 film societies on campus, and every night you could see, choose from like 10 different films. It was fantastic.
Amazing.
But I saw this film, and it knocked me out, and I thought, I've just seen this guy's masterpiece. And I realized he had made many, many films, and how could I possibly know that? But I just felt it was so perfect. I mean, it's one of those few films that are perfect. There are a lot of great films that are imperfect for one reason or another, and that's fine. Citizen Kane is a perfect film. You know, everything works.
Trouble in Paradise is like that. It's really, you know, it's like a beautiful clock that all the mechanisms work beautifully, but it has a strong heart. But after all these years, I've now seen everything that exists by Lubitsch, except they've rediscovered a film in part that I have not seen called The Rosentopf Case, which is a 1917 detective movie comedy where he plays a bungling detective. It was just shown at the Bologna Cinema Retrovato, so I thought I had seen all the extant Lubitsch, but now I have to track that one down. I'm glad they found another one. Sure. But it took a long, long time for me to see these films, and I still feel Trouble in Paradise is his best film after watching everything else.
Okay, well, that I think is a good place to start in terms of talking about the evolution of this book and this critical study that you've just recently published. Let's start with what inspired you to take up this project.
Well, part of it is that selfish motivation that I just wanted to see his films. And back in the 60s, a lot of these films had been not shown on television. I mean, you know, one reason we got to see a lot of films in the 50s and 60s was they wound up on TV and there were 16 millimeter prints being distributed. And Lubitsch's films often had been withdrawn because of the code, which was enforced, the production code as of 1934. They got strict with it. And some of his films, they wouldn't allow studios to reissue because they were too racy. And so they were not sometimes put on TV. And Lubitsch died in 1947, and he had, you know, it wasn't around to burnish his legend like a lot of the other old directors were. And when I was a young guy, I made it my mission to interview as many of them as I could, people I admired, and I was fortunate when I went to Hollywood that a lot of them were still around. But I think Lubitsch's reputation had waned partly because of that. He wasn't there to talk and promote his films. But Trouble in Paradise came back in the late 60s in 16 millimeter. It looked beautiful. I've seen it many times in 35 and 16. It looks great. The DVD actually doesn't look all that great because the first 5 minutes are very dark because they take place at night. Mm. But they're printed too dark, and you can hardly see what's going on. And so you miss – it opens with a great Lubitsch touch, which is his hallmark, and we can talk about that. But it starts with a garbage man. It starts with a very grubby-looking shot of a garbage can in a doorway. And then a garbage man picks it up, and he walks with it in the camera pans, and then you see the Grand Canal of Venice with all the lights and, you know, flickering, and it's really a beautiful shot. But when you see it in 35, it's spectacular and funny, and the part of the gag is that it goes from this very mundane, grubby scene that could take place anywhere to an establishing shot of Venice. And Lubitsch likes to reverse the usual cinematic language. Usually a film will start with an establishing shot of New York or Paris or Venice or whatever it is, and then go to the, you know, more intimate shots. But he does the opposite, and that's funny in itself. And then the guy pours the garbage into a gondola. It's a garbage gondola, which is funny. And then he starts singing "O Solo Mio," "O Solo Mio," which means "Oh my sunshine." So it's a wonderful Lubitsch touch, and he and Samson Raphaelson, the screenwriter, spent three whole days just figuring that out. But it kind of goes for naught when you show it on the screen. First of all, it depends on the audience being aware of certain conventions that Lubitsch is playing with and subverting. But if you can't see what's going on, it right. kind of spoils it. But anyway,
it's near impossible. Yeah. What about the Criterion Blu-ray?
Well, there isn't a Blu-ray of that one yet, and I have a note here to lobby Criterion. It's time to have a Blu-ray. They put out a DVD edition that has some nice extras and things on it, but they need to fix that element.
Yeah. Okay.
There is a Criterion Blu-ray coming out of Heaven Can Wait shortly.
Okay.
And
oh, okay.
There's one of Design for Living, which I was involved in a few years ago. I did a video interview, and it looks fabulous. But these films, when they're seen on the big screen, as I've seen, I curated early in my research, which went on for 9 years in this book, I curated a retrospective of Lubitsch films at the Locarno Film Festival in Switzerland in 2010. And we got all the best prints we could find from archives around the world. And so I got to see the best 35 prints that we could get our hands on of everything, which was really great. Yeah. There were a few that are needed restoration. For example, Rosita, his first American film, has just been restored by the Museum of Modern Art. It looks fabulous. And it existed at the time in very bad dupes from Russia, as does Forbidden Paradise, another terrific American silent film. And the Museum of Modern Art has restored that. It's going to be shown at the Pordenone Film Festival this fall. And I'm told by Dave Kerr, their curator who supervises restorations, that it looks great, as does Rosita. And he said they found 90% of Forbidden Paradise. It's a wonderful movie, but when you see these rotten dupes, you know, very fuzzy and all that, and some shots are missing or they go by too fast or whatever, it's not a great way to see a film.
Right.
But a lot of the films look fabulous when you see a good studio print, you know, like The Smiling Lieutenant or other films look really stunning on the big screen. But anyway, Trouble in Paradise, it got me going. Over the years, I kept thinking, well, geez, you know, I love this guy's work, and then I would see more of them. But very few of them were trickling out onto home video. I would see them in theaters or archives. Like, I lived in Los Angeles at the time, and the L.A. County Museum of Art would do a Lubitsch retrospective occasionally, so I got to see some of them on the big screen. But a lot of them were impossible to see, and then when home video came out, very few of them were on home video until, I'd say, around 2003, 2004, they started coming out. There was a wonderful box set, which I'd recommend, Lubitsch in Berlin, which has several of his German films and a very good documentary on them by Robert Fisher. And a number of the other ones have come on to home video. So it's not as bad as it used to be, but still, some of the films are missing in action. Like, you can't get an American DVD of Clooney Brown, his last really good film, and Angel is hard to see. And oddly enough, his 1920s American silent period is very spotty in terms of availability, and it's kind of scandalous. But, you know, I just wanted to see these films, so I figured, well, you know, when you do a book, you have to put out a lot of energy and expenses, and, you know, I finance these things myself and then sell them to a publisher. So I needed an excuse to go to Europe, and I went to Europe 3 times to see his films. Mm. Got to see them all, and also collectors would give me copies of some of the rare ones, which was great. So that was my motivation, number one. But the other was to help bring him more into the public consciousness, because I was really bothered that he was not talked about very much. I mean, he was recognized by some people as a great filmmaker. And most people, if you see Lubitsch films, you flip over them, you know. I mean, you were my TA in the Lubitsch Wilder class. If you remember, when we showed the Lubitsch films to students, they were ecstatic, weren't they?
I think so. I think they're delightful to anyone who cares to watch them. I think there's a timeless quality to them.
Yeah, the students were saying, well, my gosh, these films were made, you know, in the 30s, and these are so sophisticated and so advanced and sexy. And wow.
And people still love a dirty joke.
Yeah. You know? Mean, it's timeless. Well, they're more advanced than our films today, and much more adult and more sophisticated. And they were kind of amazed that he got away with all this stuff. And, but they're just very funny and entertaining. And so, you know, there are pockets of Lubitsch fans everywhere, but he's not shown much in college classes, with maybe a couple of exceptions of To Be or Not to Be is shown fairly often, and Ninotchka. Those are the ones that people have seen the most, I think, in Shop Around the Corner. Yeah. But he's not written about that much. There have been some books about him that are pretty good, but hadn't been many books about him for a long time. And there had never been a critical study that covered his entire career in Germany and America in depth. There was a book in Germany that dealt with the whole career, but it was sort of sketches of, you know, like it was a collection of reviews and quotes and short commentaries and things. But there were books on his German films, and then there were books on his American films, but nobody had totally tied it together. There is a biography, but it doesn't, it's not really adequate on the films. But so I thought, you know, a critical study is needed to really deal with his complete body of work and make sense of it. And I don't think you can understand him totally unless you know the German work. And so it required me to go outside my comfort zone. I've been writing about American films mostly my whole life because it's my specialty. And, you know, everybody has to, I mean, you can't write about everything. So that's my specialty. But I thought it's a good challenge to write about films of a different culture. And so I had to get familiar with German culture and history. And that was really interesting and fun. And I felt, you know, it worked well. And, you know, I'm glad people liked those parts of the book.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly something that I don't consider as much when I think about Lubitsch. I primarily focus on his mid to late Hollywood period. Although Trouble in Paradise kind of falls somewhere squarely in the middle. But before we get to that, I do want to just get a couple things out of the way. There are a couple of, I think, big questions that people who know nothing about Lubitsch need to understand, and know nothing, are not familiar with you and your work, need to understand. One is, where does the title of the book come from?
Well, Billy Wilder, who I've always revered, and actually I'm doing a critical study of him too. I've been working on that for a number of years, kind of in parallel with Lubitsch. And Wilder's films are much more accessible. You can get copies of everything, and he didn't do as many films as Lubitsch. And I got to interview him a number of times. And so on his wall of his office, he had a sign that Saul Steinberg did for him, the New Yorker artist. It says, how would Lubitsch do it? And so he said he put that sign on his wall so he could never write a sentence that would make him ashamed to show his good friend Ernst Lubitsch, is the way he put it. So I love that, you know, idea that a guy had that sign on his wall, and he was Lubitsch's most successful protege. So I thought, okay, how did Lubitsch do it? Is would be a fun title. And I did a book called Whatever Happened to Orson Welles. I kind of like those question mark titles because it's provocative, and it makes you, you know, it's sort of the agenda of the book is to explain how this man did it.
Sure, yeah, yeah. It's a good research question, too.
Also has a double entendre, which is fitting to the subject.
Sure, yeah, if we want to get there. And then the other big question, which we've sort of danced around, this sort of ineffable quality that is imbued throughout Lubitsch's best work is the so-called Lubitsch touch, which is kind of, I guess, like, it has a number of definitions. Many have attempted to define it. It might be a sort of, you know, when you see it kind of quality, but how would you describe it?
Yeah, it's like Potter Stewart, the Supreme Court Justice, once defined pornography. He said, well, you can't define it, but you know it when you see it. You know?
Right, exactly, yeah. Which, again, fitting for Lubitsch, right?
Yeah, I mean, because part of it was he got away with sexual jokes and, you know, James Harvey did a pretty good study of his American films, and he wrote that Lubitsch got away. He said one reason fellow directors admired Lubitsch was he got away with dirty jokes on the screen, and they wondered how you can do that. But he said what he got away with more was intelligence, which was really hard to get away with in the days of the studio system. But the Lubitsch touch is a marketing phrase that Kristen Thompson did a book in Lubitsch, and she tried to trace the origins of it. And she said she didn't do a complete thorough study, but the best she could find was it originates in the early 20s in American film criticism, that critics started writing about his continental touch because he was bringing continental European sophistication to American screens. And then it soon evolved into calling it the Lubitsch touch. And then other reviewers and studios started picking up on it as a marketing ploy, and it became like Hitchcock being the master of suspense, which is a phrase that I've always thought is very limiting for Hitchcock. And with Lubitsch, though, I kind of like the phrase the Lubitsch touch because it connotes a certain delicacy and sensuality, which are, you know, fitting to him. And but it is a nebulous thing, but it does exist. And when you see the films, you know what, I mean, all through the book, I try to define it in certain ways and I give examples of it. And I also found, with the help of a couple of researchers and Howard Prouty of the Academy, there were many, many interviews with Lubitsch over the years that people had not really read for a long time in the press, and both in Germany and the U.S. And also, Paramount put out a lot of press releases about Lubitsch, and they were actually quite good. They interviewed him a lot, and they had a lot of quotes about his working method and his philosophy, and then he would sometimes be the credited author of the releases, and very intelligent commentary on his own work. And so I was able to quote those, which had been kind of ignored. And he was prone to joking about the Lubitsch touch. He would say things like, well, if you figure out what it is, please tell me, you know.
Right.
And he also said at one point, I don't want to know what it is because then I'll become self-conscious, which I'm sure was true. But sometimes he would say things about it. I'll read a definition that he gave toward the end of his life. He gave an interview with American Cinematographer magazine. And he said to the interviewer, Molly Merrick, what exactly, you ask me, is the Lubitsch touch? It's the king in his bedroom with his suspenders hanging. It's the gondola hauling garbage in Venice while the gondolier sings romantically in the moonlight. It's the husband bidding his wife a melancholy goodbye and then dashing madly for the nearest telephone booth. It's naughty and it's gay. It's based on the theory that at least twice a day, the most dignified of human beings is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good description.
Sure.
But in practice, it gets to the essence of his style, too, because he, as Truffaut put it, Lubitsch had a horror of ever saying anything directly. He would always be indirect. And he would always, he loved to devise clever ways of showing things but not showing them, because just showing people kissing or having sex or something, first of all, you know, some of that you couldn't do at all in those days, so he had to get around it. But it's not as interesting as oblique commentary on those things. There's a famous example Truffaut gives in Angel, where a woman has dinner with her husband and a man who loves her, and the husband isn't aware that the man and the woman have had some kind of romance. And but the way he never shows the dinner, he just shows the servants in the side room receiving the plates as they come back from the table. And all three people have done different things to their veal. One of them, the husband has just polished off the veal obliviously. And if I remember correctly, the suitor has chopped his veal into little bits and hasn't eaten any. And I forget what Marlena Dietrich does to hers, but anyway, it's all done through the food and the close-ups and the reactions of the servants. It's very funny and very witty, and you know, a great way to show something. And it gets into a subtext of a scene because it shows you what people are feeling and thinking beneath the surface. And if you showed people sitting and talking, you could convey some of that. But it's a clever way to do it. And Lubitsch would, as Truffaut said, he would rack his brains for, you know, 20 years thinking of these things. And I'm sorry, could we just take that again?
Sure.
Truffaut said Lubitsch, you know, would racked his brains trying to think of unusual ways to say things. And he said he bled himself white and died 20 years too early because of that.
Yeah.
He died at age 55 of a heart condition. And he was a workaholic, but he would spend days with Samson Raphaelson and other writers coming up with these oblique, clever, suggestive ways of doing things, innuendo. And his most famous way of doing things was the door shot. He would show doors, and behind the door, you would usually know what's going on, but it wouldn't be seen. And that's partly a joke on censorship, because in American films, you couldn't go into the bedroom and show what's going on in bed. But you get the sense of what's happening with innuendo. And he uses an infinite variety of those kinds of shots. And they stem from the theater to some extent. He was the theater actor for Max Reinhardt, the great German, Austrian-German director, who was the leading director in Europe. And doors are very important on the stage because, you know, characters' entrances and exits are very important. And in films, you can do all different kinds of things. But there's a shot in The Marriage Circle, which is a masterpiece of American silent filmmaking, where a wife and a man who is pursuing her go behind a door, and you don't really know what happens behind that door, and it's enigmatic, and the way Lubitsch gets that across is very interesting. He just holds the shot longer than you expect.
Right, yeah.
That's kind of his subtle form of direction. That film is a stunning film, probably his most influential film, and I wish people would look at that. It was on YouTube until recently, and it was pulled. There is a version on YouTube that has a horrible musical score, so I wouldn't recommend it. But it's a very influential film. People like Hitchcock and Ozu and all kinds of directors, Michael Powell, said they were inspired to be.
You spend a lot of time on The Marriage Circle in your book. It seems pretty clear that one is pretty special to you.
Yeah, and if people are interested, they can look in the online magazine Bright Lights, which is a very good film magazine that Gary Morris puts out, and I have the section on The Marriage Circle there for free. And I also have the first part of the book where I define or introduce the notion of the Lubitsch touch. And that's the film I think that really changed Hollywood the most of any Lubitsch film. He invented the romantic comedy. I think you could make that claim. And he had a lot to do with inventing the musical. When I was in Locarno, I talked to Jean Duché, who's a very elderly French critic of great influence. And he said to me, the Oyster Princess in that film, Lubitsch invented the musical. It's a silent film. And I said, well, what do you mean? And there's a sequence called the Foxtrot Epidemic, where at a wedding, everybody breaks into the foxtrot, including the guests and the servants. It's just uproariously funny. And it goes on for several minutes, and it really is a musical number in a silent film. And silent films, we have to remember, were never silent because they always had either an orchestra or at least somebody playing the piano or an organ. And so he would do these silent musical numbers. And then, so this is Paris, which has also been restored recently. There's a fantastic Charleston contest, which is this very elaborate musical number, 1926, you know?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, I guess Lubitsch kind of prized himself on being able to kind of subvert audience expectations and throw in surprising little details and touches. And so I'm curious, when working on a director who is so keen on something new and interesting around every corner, was there something in your research that, in particular, that surprised you?
Well, I mean, just seeing some of these German films was a surprise because you discover these gems. Like there's one called Cole Hiesel's Daughters, which nobody seems to have seen. It was never released in America, unlike some of his other ones, apparently because they considered it too German. It's a big popular film in Germany. They remade it several times. It's a Bavarian sex farce. And it's very rustic and funny. And to me, it's just a very funny sex farce, but I don't know why people would find it too German, you know. Too German. But it's got Henny Porten, who was their favorite actress at the time, who plays a spectacular double role as a kind of a sweet, matronly woman whose father owns a country inn. And then her sister, who's a very homely, angry, bitter woman who's the barmaid, and so they play this. She plays this double role really wonderfully, and it's kind of a takeoff from The Taming of the Shrew. Just a wonderful movie, and so that was a discovery. But The Oyster Princess, I've been hearing about that for years, and that's just a wonderful film. You can see that on YouTube in a very good print. So I mean, finding things like that. But the silent Hollywood masterpieces, too, in addition to The Marriage Circle, Lady Windermere's Fan is wonderful, and that you can get that on DVD as well as The Marriage Circle. But just, you know, some of the personal experiences, for example, when I went to Berlin, I always believe in going to the places where the directors I write about came from. And Goethe, the German poet, playwright, said, to understand a poet, you must go unto the poet's land. So fortunately, the neighborhood where Lubitsch grew up is still there, survived the Holocaust, even though most of the people there did not. But the home, the apartment building where he lived with his family is still there. His birthplace right around the corner is gone, but it was a Cajun restaurant when I was there.
Okay.
That's kind of interesting. American.
I think he would appreciate that.
Yeah, I think he'd say right. It's called the Louisiana Kid, you know.
Okay.
and at the corner was the family tailor shop. His father was a tailor, women's tailor. And the mother was helping run the shop. And according to Lubitsch's daughter, Nicola, who's a friend of mine, the mother did most of the work while the father sat around cafes and ogled pretty women and stuff. Yeah. But it was a shop that specialized in large women, coats for large women. And in the apartment building on the ground floor, there was a workspace where the coats were made. And then higher up, there'd be they had two floors of apartments, one for the children, one for the parents. So I got to talk my way in with the help of my wonderful translator and guide, Esther Tampa, who's an actress who speaks German and English. And she was great because she talked our way into the building, and then we knocked on doors and people let us into the apartments, and they were great. They haven't changed very much, but what was wonderful was there's so many doors within doors within doors. Mm. You can kind of see where he got that, because it's like a maze almost inside these the children's apartment. It's just wonderful. And so that was a surprise. Another wonderful thing, she got us into the Max Reinhardt Theater. It was closed for the day, but she talked to the two guys who were guarding the theater, and they let us in, and they let me on the stage, and they actually turned on the lights at one point. I stood on the stage where Lubitsch acted and was flooded by spotlights. That was a really big thrill.
Ah, so Max Reinhardt, it's notably where Lubitsch got his start as a performer, correct?
Yeah, he was considered, you know, the leading director in Europe, tremendously influential. His genius was, back in the 19th century, directors were not that important in the theater. The stage manager usually was the director, but Reinhardt pioneered the idea of that the play was a kind of a complete entity, a visual spectacle as well as dramatic. And he was famous for his great direction of crowd scenes and atmosphere and lighting and things like that. So it was a great education for Lubitsch. But he was so prestigious that Lubitsch never got to play very important parts for him. He was there for 7 years and always played small supporting roles. He was not a terribly handsome guy. He wasn't a leading man type. He was more of a comedian. And he played like the second gravedigger in Hamlet, for example, you know, and that gets into his work, because when you see To Be or Not to Be, he loves those two guys who are the spear carriers, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So he understands the plight and the humor of being a bit part actor, and he loves those kind of people. But he got to do a lot of Shakespeare, and he played a servant of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, for example, and he did a lot of other plays. They did many classic plays of Strindberg and Schiller and all kinds of things that he learned from, and it was a great education for him, and he stuck it out, I think, because he was learning so much, even while he was starting to be a film actor. And films in those days were just beginning, so it was not prestigious at all to be in films. But if you wanted to make some money, then it was a time of great economic hardship, of course. And so actors would do a film in the daytime and then a play at night. And Lubitsch was doing that, you know, and when you're young, you can work that hard. And so he was starting to make films, and he very soon became a film star. His comedy appealed to audiences, and also within short order, he got to direct his own films. But he was still working for Reinhardt, and so that was his greatest influence. And Reinhardt would just say things to him like, ride the laugh. He would yell at him if Lubitsch got a laugh and he started the next line before the laugh had finished, Reinhardt would get angry at him, you know, and Lubitsch learned about timing and things like that from Reinhardt.
Well, that's interesting. And just as far as his filmic influences goes, who were a couple? I mean, you make specific mention of a few notable directors who influenced Lubitsch. One is Charlie Chaplin, very notably, and Moritz Stiller. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Those are the two who are the precursors. Chaplin's The Woman of Paris is often cited as the most important influence on Lubitsch, but Billy Wilder said that Lubitsch told him he got everything from Stiller's Eroticon, which precedes Woman of Paris. Eroticon was a 1920 Swedish film, Woman of Paris, 1923, but they're both profoundly influential on Lubitsch. Eroticon is a delightful romantic comedy. And, you know, when I say Lubitsch created the romantic comedy, well, Eroticon is a predecessor. It's kind of like bringing a baby, or, you know, those kind of Hawks films in which it's about a kind of absent-minded professor who's an entomologist studying insects, and his wife is very kind of hot to trot and has an aviator lover, and she's wonderful. Tora Tia was the actress, and is very clever and very witty. And then the husband has this kind of strange attraction to his niece, which is pretty pretty bizarre too. Mm-hmm. So it's a very racy film, but done with Lubitschian innuendo and obliqueness, and he learned an awful lot from that. But then Chaplin's first, I wouldn't say first dramatic film, because he had done The Kid, which is a pretty dramatic film, but Woman of Paris was a film in which Chaplin did not star. He has only a little cameo, but it's about a young woman who goes to, she's supposed to elope with her lover from a small repressive town and winds up, through a series of mistakes, being a kept woman in Paris of Adolphe Manjou. And there's a gigantic ellipsis in which all that happens to her, and you don't see it. She's corrupted off screen, and she appears at a nightclub, and she's a great lady of scandalous reputation. And it's a very sophisticated, wry, kind of sardonic sex comedy, and very cleverly directed, wonderful film. And the audience didn't really respond terribly well, because they were, you know, baffled, where is Chaplin, you know. But it was a very influential film on certain film directors, and Lubitsch heaped praise on that film, and he learned a lot about how to convey adult sexual values on the screen in America. And he also thought Chaplin respects the intelligence of the spectator and doesn't talk down to the spectator, which is very important, and that's something Lubitsch is known for. And when Lubitsch came from Germany to America, his German films are broader and somewhat coarse in some ways, although in a fun way. He got more sophisticated in America, and he revolutionized the American cinema that way. Part of it was he thought, well, in Europe they accept open sexuality without much concern. He said they get more concerned about violence, and that's still really true. But in America, we had this very Puritan society. We still do, and it's in some ways it's worse again. But Lubitsch was counteracting American Puritanism by opening up our eyes to adult relationships on the screen and complexities of people's behavior, married couple and marriage circle, where the husband is tempted to stray and the wife has thoughts of libidinous thoughts of her own. And he often has three-way romances going on in his films, and even a threesome, a menage a trois in Design for Living, which is really pretty stunning film, pre-code film, but it got some censorship even at the time. But it's pretty amazing when you see he got away with that in 1933. So he pulled off a lot of sort of European-style sophistication. Most of his American films are set in Europe, interestingly enough, because part of the point is you could get away with more that way, because people can say, oh, those naughty French people are carrying on, you know. And very few of them take place in America, just That Uncertain Feeling and Heaven Can Wait and Three Women. I think offhand those are the three well, Designed for Living, part of it takes place in America, but most of them take place in France or other countries, or these mythical kingdoms that come from the operatic traditions. Yeah. So you could get away with more in those films. And also, a number of things happen. Hollywood has always been more tolerant of racy things that come from the stage or from novels. You know, if it comes from a previous work, that you can get away with it. There are certain films you wonder, like, how did they ever make this film? Well, it's because Hollywood has a certain respect for the literary source. And Lubitsch made very few films based on novels. Mostly they're based on plays, but he could always say, well, the play, The Merry Widow, did such and such, so I'm doing the same thing, and, you know, he got away with it. That was part of his thing. But I found a letter from one of the censors who said, well, we can rely on Lubitsch to deal with these themes subtly because that's his style, and he has a light touch. And they respected that, and they understood that. And one of the censors also said, we know what he's saying, but we can't figure out how he's saying it, so we can't censor it, you know.
Most any place can seem to be a paradise, while you embrace just the one that you adore. There needn't be an apple tree with magic powers. You need no garden filled with flowers.
Yeah, I do want to make sure we have plenty of time to discuss Trouble in Paradise. So should we just dive right into that film? Do you think there's any further plot summary required?
Well, I think the thing, you know, you were asking me what I love about this film so much. You could talk for hours about the wonderful style. Lubitsch said, for pure style, I don't think I've done anything as good as Trouble in Paradise. And it's dazzling in its camera work and the way the camera comments on the action and the very clever touches. For example, there's this long sequence where Herbert Marshall goes out in the town with Kay Francis, and then they come back and they're falling in love. And it's all done with a series of clocks, dissolves to different clocks that are very beautifully, you know, designed clocks. And it's a real audacious kind of scene, how to show something without showing it at all. And it's very witty, and you have the dialogue over it, and you have some music, and, you know, it's a pretty amazing way to play with narrative. He experimented with narrative. But I think that the reason I like that film so much is the emotional component of it. And I think that sometimes in film writing, you see this with, say, Spielberg. I wrote a biography of Spielberg, and a lot of the books on Spielberg are about his technical genius, you know, and they go into great detail about how he did the shots, but they never talk about the story. And so in my book, I tried to focus on the story and the characters, you know, equally. And with Lubitsch, the same thing. It's not just stylistic flourishes which make him so good. The flourishes mean something, and they have an emotional content. And in Trouble in Paradise, what it really is about is a man who's in love with two equally alluring women. And often in movies, Hollywood films, what they do is they load the dice by having one woman be more attractive than the other physically or in a behavioral sense. You know, you're kind of directed to one or the other. But what Lubitsch does, he makes both of them wonderful. There's Miriam Hopkins and Kay Francis, and they're both terrific. And you fall in love with both of them, just like Herbert Marshall does in the film. And you can't really choose, and that's kind of the dilemma. And there's a melancholy underneath the Lubitsch humor. And Andrew Sarris pointed out, he thought the counterpoint between sadness and humor is really the Lubitsch touch. I think that's a good observation. And Miriam Hopkins, Lubitsch loved her, he adored her. I think he had a big crush on her, but it was unrequited. And she was very saucy and very witty and funny and independent and flighty and has a tremendous sense of humor. And Kay Francis is more womanly in the sense of being more dignified. And she plays the head of a perfume company. And at first you kind of think, well, she must be a snob or something. She's a rich, spoiled woman. But she actually turns out to be a very good person who... One of the first things she does is refuse to cut the salaries of the workers This is during the Depression era, and people only recently been noticing that Trouble in Paradise is very political, and that it's really about the Depression. It's obsessed with money. There are many references to money in the economic system, and it's about celebrating two people living by their wits by being crooks. Everybody in the film is a crook in one way or the other.
Right.
And Kay Francis, even though she's a good-hearted person, is a capitalist, and her
Nobody comes by their money honestly, really.
No. The guy who runs the board of directors is an out-and-out embezzler, and Herbert Marshall's a very clever jewel thief, and he gets away with it, but he has to abscond at the end because he would go to jail. But he's partly blackmailing the guy who runs the company for Kay Francis because the guy's been stealing her blind for years. So it's everybody's a crook, but you know, it's kind of subversive because you love the two main crooks, but you also love the lady who's running the factory because she's so gracious. At the end of the film, to me, the most poignant moment in Lubitsch is when she has to surrender Herbert Marshall to Miriam Hopkins. And Lubitsch, in Monte Carlo, his musical, there's a song about how this woman has to follow the dictates of society. And I think that Lubitsch's films, that's part of what they're about, is this struggle between the independent streak in people, romantic, adventurous streak, and the dictates of society, and how there's a push-pull going on all the time. And so Kay Francis has to say goodbye to Herbert Marshall, who really wishes he could stay with her, but he can't really have two women at once. And Miriam Hopkins is getting very angry and jealous, and so he has a very elaborate farewell scene with Kay Francis and steals some jewels from her, some pearls that Miriam Hopkins wants, and he says, your gift to her. First he says, do you know what you're missing? And Kay Francis closes her eyes and smiles and says, yeah, she nods. And you know, it's just kind of a sexual innuendo, which is rather sweet and touching. And then he says, no, this is what you're missing. And he pulls these jewels out, which is sort of, you know, Lubitsch kind of undercutting the sentimentality, as he always does. And then Kay Francis smiles, and she nods, and she says, with the compliments of Collet and company. She's Madame Collet. That's my favorite moment in Lubitsch. It's so gracious and so sweet and so generous, you know.
Yeah. Do you ever have the sense that she just deserves better?
Yeah, you do. You wish that she would have a happy romantic life, because she has these two suitors who are kind of eunuchs.
Right.
Charlie Ruggles and Edward Everett Horton.
Yeah. I just wonder about those two. it occurred to me watching it this time that they kind of are a precursor to possibly Design for Living, in that they almost end up falling in love with each other.
Well, they're with each other all the time talking about sex, you know, because they're both obsessed with this woman who doesn't care for them. She likes having them around because they worship her, but she kind of puts them down all the time. There's a wonderful line. Rafelson wrote such great dialogue. One of them, Edward Everett Horton, proposes to her all the time, and at one point she says, marriage is a beautiful mistake which two people make together. And then she turns to him and she says, but in your case, it would be a mistake.
It's good.
Yeah.
I mean, everything about that movie just really works, as you say. It is kind of, it functions like clockwork, which is, as you mentioned, a big motif in the film.
Yeah, and the feeling of time passing and the kind of pressure of time, because there's kind of a urgency to the film. It's like Max Ophuls' films, like in Le Ron, the characters are always saying, what time is it? Because time is pressing on them and time is running out for romance. And in this case, Trouble in Paradise, Gaston is always worried about being caught. And this idol that he has going on will be soon terminated. And it adds a great poignancy to the film. And it ends with a scene in a taxi cab where he's riding away with Miriam Hopkins. It's really uproarious, where they're revealing that they both robbed Kay Francis blind with all kinds of stuff. And it always reminds me of the ending of Hemingway's Sun Also Rises, which ends in a taxi cab with the couple riding away. And one of them says, wouldn't it be you know, it would be nice if we had this great romance, but the guy's penis was blown off in World War One.
Right.
And she says, it wouldn't be lovely to think so. It's sad, but romantic at the same time. And then Design for Living has a scene like that. But in that film, basically, the woman and the two guys agree to live with each other again. And right. And they're going to go off to some new sexual adventure, which is pretty pretty astounding.
That ending is winning, I got to say.
Yeah.
Design for Living. People should check that one out.
Molly Haskell says it gleefully demolishes every standard of morality in Hollywood films, and even bohemian morality. She said that the monogamous relationship is kind of destroyed in that film too. You know, it's got it's a really a reckless, wild, wonderful, funny film.
Yeah. Pretty radical for the time, I would say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, should we talk about how body Trouble in Paradise is? Do you have any favorite sort of dirty jokes that he's snuck in there?
Well, there's a wonderful scene where the butler is confused about doors, like what door are they coming out of, you know? Like it's very funny. It's hard to describe. You have to see these scenes because the timing and the visual complexity are so intricate that Herbert Marshall, you never know if he actually consummates his relationship with Kay Francis or not, but they're behind certain doors and you think they might. But one way Lubitsch shows that, there's a great scene where they kiss and then he shows reflections of the kiss in a mirror, and then their silhouettes are reflected on the bed, which is a great way of implying that maybe they had sex, but maybe they didn't. Also, it's there's a kind of a sadness when you see silhouettes on a bed that you kind of think, well, maybe this could have happened, but it never did.
Sure, yeah, Spectre. I mean, in the next shot, isn't the bed, next time we see the bed, it's still made, right?
Yeah, it's made. Yeah. And so, I mean, he's playing with censorship and things he couldn't say in American films, but having fun with it. And he's depending on our spectatorial intelligence to understand the game he's playing in. Wilder said, you know, a lot of directors will say 2 + 2 = 4 or 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 4. But he said Lubitsch just says 2 + 2 and that's it. And you have to add it up yourself. And he said Lubitsch said, if you do that, the audience will love you for it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about how Lubitsch's approach to working with actors, coming from a sort of stage background himself, an acting background himself, one would imagine that he had maybe picked up a few things about the way that actors prefer to work. But his style seems kind of unconventional and perhaps frustrating for a lot of actors, I could imagine.
Well, he did something you're not supposed to do, which is he acted out all the parts for the actors to show them how to do the parts. Sure. Chaplin did that. He got away with it because he was Chaplin, a supreme egotist. But Lubitsch would do that. And Peter Bogdanovich loves to tell the story of he met Jack Benny and he asked him about that. Jack Benny is just wonderful in To Be or Not to Be, such a casting coup. And he said, well, Lubitsch would act out all the parts, right? And Benny said, well, yes, but... he said it was a little broad, but you got the idea, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was sort of funny that, I mean, Lubitsch was not a great actor. You can tell from his early films. He stopped acting after 1920. He was way over the top, which kind of worked in comedies. But when he did a drama, it was kind of embarrassing. But if he's playing, like I have a shot in my book, How Did Lubitsch Do It? He's playing Gene Tierney embracing Don Ameche in Heaven Can Wait, and they're both looking on with smiles, you know, and so the crew is all smiling. I'm sure it was very funny. And I told John Ford about that when I interviewed him. I was trying to get his sense of how he directed John Wayne, and I just said, well, Lubitsch and Chaplin acted out all the parts for the actors, and he said, well, I'd love to see that. And he said, it must have been pretty funny. But it was funny, and it put the audience, it put the cast in a good mood, I guess. In the Lubitsch films, they all had a good time, and they weren't imitating Lubitsch so much as, you know, he was indicating what he kind of wanted from them. But he wanted their own style. He wanted their own take on it. And yet, as Bogdanovich points out, there's a kind of a certain rhythm to Lubitsch's dialogue, and the actors have a certain style that comes across, and I think that's partly what Lubitsch was conveying. And he also worked very intensely on the scripts with Samson Raphaelson wrote 9 of the scripts, and then he had other fine writers. Hans Crowley wrote most of his silent films, and Ben Hecht wrote Design for Living, etc., Bracken and Wilder. And Wilder said Lubitsch was the best writer in the world, and he said, I don't mean just film writer, just best writer in the world, you know. He really was, in a sense, like Hitchcock. He had the script perfect before he went on the set. He didn't really change much. And he actually would call Raphaelson to the set if he needed a line change. He was that careful about it. So everything was really worked out in advance. Right. And
again, like a well-oiled machine.
Yeah. And to give you an example, he said Herbert Marshall was one of the few actors, if maybe the only one, he never really even had to direct in Trouble in Paradise because he was so perfect. He was a good stage actor and beautiful delivery of dialogue and very suave, and he just fit the Lubitschian world perfectly. And Lubitsch said, I didn't have to tell him anything, you know, I just did it. And John Huston, who I knew and worked with on Wells is the Other Side of the Wind, used to say that that's the best form of directing actors, is where you don't have to say much. You know, he said, and somebody said, well, how do you do that? And he said, well, first of all, it's just casting. If you cast the right people, you don't have to say anything. And so Lubitsch was great with casting, and he had an offbeat sense of casting. Like, who else would think of Jack Benny and playing a Nazi impersonator? Is so great. Doing Hamlet, etc. It's just a stunning performance. But Herbert Marshall was also rather stiff in a sense. I mean, literally, he was in World War I, he lost a leg, and he had a wooden leg. And Lubitsch seemed to have fun with that because he shows repeated shots in Trouble in Paradise of Marshall running up and down stairs very fast. And you can tell he goes out of the frame briefly, and then a double runs up the stairs, and Lubitsch has fun with that. But the stiffness is counteracted by his suave style, but there's a certain kind of formality to the character that this man is putting on. He's a jewel thief. He could be a lowlife, but he behaves like a gentleman. And Lubitsch was very aware of class, and he made there's a line in there where Marshall says rather bitterly that you have to be in the social register to avoid going to jail. Right. You know, good commentary on the way the world works even today.
Right. Yeah. And a great line.
Yeah. And the women in the film, Hopkins is a madcap, wonderful comedian, like a Roman candle of fun. And Kay Francis, when I first saw this film, I thought, wow, she's so sexy and so soignée and so wonderful. I want to see more of her. And I started seeing more of her films, and I was disappointed because she seems very kind of bland and sort of dull. And I thought, geez. And then I realized, well, Lubitsch brought out qualities in her that other people didn't bring out.
Sure, yeah. Well, I love her. She's, just as a figure in Hollywood, I think she's really interesting, the whole box office poison business and sort of notorious bisexuality, and she's just a fun pre-code figure, you know.
Would you say, based on your knowledge, that more of that comes out in Trouble in Paradise than in her usual performances,
right? Sure. Yeah. I wish there were more roles that suited her. I wish more people knew her.
Yeah, I think that's
she's so wonderful in this.
Yeah, as you suggest, her off-screen life was much racier than they allowed her to be on screen. Kind of like Mary Astor, you know, in a sense.
I love Mary Astor.
It was a great period for women. Molly Haskell, from Reverence to Rape, talks about the 30s as being the great period for women in American films. That they dominated the screen, all these great actresses, the films were made around them. But there were kind of limits on what they're allowed to get away with. But you needed a great director who understood and sympathized with their sexuality and their the freedom and independence, like Lubitsch. I think he brought out the best in every actor he worked with. very few people give bad performances in his films. I can think of very few. Actually, the only one I can think of is Burgess Meredith, and That Uncertain Feeling is unbearable. He plays this sort of insane bohemian pianist who's just, God, I mean, it's just a horrible performance. But he let him run rampant through the film. But usually,
I think I like that movie more than you do.
Really?
Yeah. You were not kind to it.
No, it grates on me. It's based on a film that's lost called Kiss Me Again. Everybody says it was one of Lubitsch's great films. It's frustrating. A number of films have been lost. He made 69 films and I think 47.
How appropriate. Good God.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
He had to stop.
He would be pleased. But I think about 48 survive, which is a pretty good survival rate. But it is tantalizing that some of his famous titles don't exist, like Kiss Me Again and Rausch, which is a German film based on a Strindberg play. It's a serious drama about alcoholism with Asta Nielsen. De Flamme, which is a German film with Paula Negri playing a prostitute. I've seen a reconstruction they've done of it. Only one reel survives. It's really good. And then they've put stills and drawings and things to flesh it out. But it's so frustrating when you read about these films and they don't exist. One I'd love to see just because of its title is My Wife, the Film Actress, with Asia Oswalda. I bet that's a delightful film, you know. And but, you know, as a silent director, I mean, somebody who started in silence, his survival record is rather good compared to some other ones, you know. The Man I Killed is another example of a Lubitsch film that's missing. I had to get a DVD from Brazil or someplace. You know, I don't know why it's so hard to see, but back in the 60s, I saw it, you know, on 16 millimeter. But so, you know, again, to circle back to our original theme, I wrote this book, How Did Lubitsch Do It? Partly to make him a household name again, if I could. He was a household name in his prime, like Hitchcock and Ford and people like that, Capra. And, I'm glad that there are pockets of Lubitsch fans coming out of the woodwork in response to the book, which is selling well and going into a second printing. But the average person, when you mention Lubitsch, they give you this blank look, which I used to get when I mentioned John Ford. I've done two books on Ford, and both times I did them was because I would get those blank looks, which are really disheartening for a film critic. You'd say, well, I love John Ford. Mm-hmm. Who is he? And so now Ford is pretty well known. You know, I've written about him, but other people have written biographies of him too. And he's part of the curriculum, et cetera. And Lubitsch is not, but I think he, you know, I'm hoping to do my bit to make him more part of the conversation. And as I mentioned, when you show the films to students and young people, they flip over them. They're very funny and witty and sexy. And so if you can see some of these, watch Trouble in Paradise, Shop Around the Corner, Ninotchka, those are great classics, To Be or Not to Be, or the ones on YouTube that we've mentioned, I Don't Want to Be a Man, The Oyster Princess, Cole Hazel's Daughters. And right there you have a good selection. I think you'll become a Lubitsch fan just by watching those.
Yeah, here. Yeah, and there are future Lubitsch films coming up on the Sight and Sound list, so make sure to stay tuned for that.
Great.
And that's the way we frame it. FlixWise, that is. Listeners, what's your all-time favorite Ernst Lubitsch movie? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com, or you can leave us a note on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/FlixWise. And if you want to trade Ninotchka impressions, you should probably follow us on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. And if you'd be so kind, please go to Apple Podcasts or your pod player of choosing and tell them what a great job we've been doing. Give us all the stars and leave us a review, please. Finally, I do want to drop everyone a reminder that Orson Welles' long-awaited The Other Side of the Wind has finally premiered. We are going to give listeners ample time to give that a watch, and then we'll have Joe back on the show to talk about his experience working as an actor on that work, and then we'll also cover some other Welles Sight and Sound entries while we're at it. But in the meantime, Joe, it was a pleasure having you back on today to talk Lubitsch.
Well, thank you to my venerated TA from the Lubitsch Wilder class.
Indeed.
You really helped me focus on a lot of the themes and style of Lubitsch, and you do it again today. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. And again, the book is called How Did Lubitsch Do It? And it is available now. Go get you a copy if you haven't already. All right. And until we meet again, keep eyes on those pocket watches. Okay.
And your pearls.
And your pearls, indeed.
Grab your pearls.
Thank you.